I do love the way he digs into describing it. He's just really, really hungry and he hasn't had breakfast. And he just starts writing, and there was turkey, and there were geese, and there were piles of chestnuts, and there were... And you can hear him just kind of breathing quicker and... Margaret, when's dinner ready?
In the back of my mind is...
It's a sort of gimme for a director, isn't it? As a kind of like, I don't even have to think about this. Press play, swoop camera, bring in all the snow you've got. Boom.
Hello and welcome to Shark Liver Oil's Christmas special. This is part two of our look at A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. I'm Matt.
I'm Dave, hello.
And this time we're going from the second of the three spirits as far as the end of the story. We won't be doing our usual reviews, etc. this time round. We're saving that for next week, which is the Christmas special. We'll be doing that, and we'll also be looking at the various retellings of A Christmas Carol, mostly in film form, but we've had a couple of other suggestions as well. And that'll be a little extra for over Christmas. I say extra, it'll just be sort of the podcast instead of our usual one. So, value.
But we'll be extra jolly, won't we? That's the aim.
Yeah, I might even try and track down some little bells to put underneath the Shark Liver Oil theme.
Do you know, that's amazing. I was thinking exactly the same thing.
A bit like that E17 song, which is in no way...
A Christmas song. It's got bells behind it in the middle eight. <For the bells. laughs>
Okay.
Let's do that. Let's make our musical aim E17 or better.
Okay.
Because you don't reach that high without aiming for it, Matt. Let's be honest.
Never accuse us of not setting the bar high. Okay, the second of the three spirits, and let's get straight into this. Now, Scrooge has already just been on sort of a whiz-bang tour through his past with some small being that appears to be a cross between a man, a child, and a candlestick.
Yes, that's exactly what he is.
And with this in mind, it's perhaps unsurprising to find that now Scrooge, it says, nothing between a baby and a rhinoceros would have astonished him very much at this stage.
What a fantastic line, by the way.
Yeah.
Bloody hell. I wrote that and I was like, Charlie, you're all right, mate. That's incredible.
Yeah, this is in the 19th century when, you know, there weren't that many rhinoceroses wandering about.
That's true. And nobody had really dug into the comic possibility of saying slightly inappropriate things next to one another. Post Monty Python, that's quite an easy joke to make. But back then, I can imagine people kind of reading it, you know, frock coat, top hat on. Yeah, Charles Dickens, a baby and a rhinoceros? Preposterous. Preposterous.
So there's he wakes up again. He's back in his bedroom, and there's a light coming from the next room. So he doesn't get sort of visited in the same way this time. Mm. He's got to go to the spirit. He opens the door, and it's almost like it's middle of the night, but it's almost like a Christmas morning, isn't it? There's just loads of streamers up everywhere, loads of Christmas decorations, presents, and sitting on this sort of pile of them is the ghost of Christmas Present, who's this giant. And he sort of laughs jollily and shouts, come in and know me better, man. It's basically a massive party.
Yeah, just two people. And I do love the way he digs into describing it. It's as if he's kind of... I could almost hear him writing this kind of when he's been... I don't know, like on Christmas morning, maybe the year before, and he's just really, really hungry and he hasn't had breakfast. And he just starts writing, and there was turkey, and there were geese, and there were piles of chestnuts, and there were... And you can hear him just kind of breathing quicker and quicker and... Margaret, when's dinner ready?
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? And it really... every one of these spirits, that the atmosphere seems so different with each one, doesn't it? Mm. And there was the sense of sort of bittersweet nostalgia with the first one, and sort of a coldness from the spirit of Christmas past, but not necessarily malevolence, just sort of, you know, this is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you said, they are what these memories, they are what they are, do not blame me. And then there's this sense of joy and just all out, just the Christmas party, Christmas Day spirit of the Ghost of Christmas Present, yeah. And then we'll get on to what then is.
Do you know what I noticed actually? First of all, with this one, you know, I was rather unfairly, it turns out, ragging on Charles Dickens or people who've adapted this since for making the Ghost of Christmas Past into Father Christmas, and I was completely wrong. It's clearly this guy who's always Father Christmas, right? He's basically written as Father Christmas, even though he's not wearing red. You know, he's this big, jolly, oh ho 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 kind of thing going on. So I was wrong. I was wrong. Makers of adaptations of this thing, I apologise. I was full of shit last time, basically.
No, not at all. Was that in the past you've read the you have read it as sort of the big guy being,
no,
or was it just you just got mixed up between the two?
Yeah, I got mixed up. I'd never read this before.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. So this is all new to me, notwithstanding 10 or 15 yeah. different adaptations when I was a child.
Yeah. Okay. So the Ghost of Christmas Present talks about how he is sort of new, and there's been more than 1,800 of his brothers in the past. So the idea is that every Christmas there's a new Ghost of Christmas Present, which I suppose makes sense, because you become, you know, you're not going to be the Christmas Ghost of Christmas Present if you've been there before. Maybe.
Yeah.
Quite an interesting idea. Now, he takes him out to see Christmas Present, and we have this great sort of, it feels like if it was a film, you know, camera swooping round this fantastic Victorian Christmas scene where the people paid to sort of clean snow off roofs and like bouncing around and throwing snowballs at each other. There's all sorts of stuff going on, people running from place to place. I had that feel in the back of my mind as I'm reading all this. I can hear then
it is actually, it's a sort of gimme for a director, isn't it, as a kind of like, I don't even have to think about this, press play, swoop camera, bring in all the snow you've got, boom.
Yeah, and he's just the Ghost of Christmas Present, just every so often intervening with his giant torch, just you know, stopping the odd arguments and just having a spreading the joy, if you like.
I quite like the, because back then this is not a torch as in a flashlight, as in something with a bulb and a piece of glass. This is presumably a big flaming branch, right?
Yeah.
And I love the idea that Charles Dickens is sort of go-to image for peace and joy being spread around the place is an elderly fella in a green tunic running around with fire just hitting people with it. There you go, you're okay. What do you mean burning? Fuck off, Christmas. Burning, I mean, you're okay. Casual arson as the spirit of the season.
What do you make of this argument that he has with the Ghost Christmas Present? Scrooge says, I wonder you, of all the beings in the many worlds about us, should desire to cramp these people's opportunities of innocent enjoyment. He says, you deprive them of their means of dining every seventh day, often the only day in which they can be said to dine at all. And the spirit gets a bit shocked at this.
Yeah.
What did you make? I kind of wasn't really sure.
It's weird. I mean, it's a great example of sort of, possibly that particular phrasing was extremely clear in Victorian English, but to me, I had to read it about 9 times before I really got my head around it. And I don't think I really did. I think the point of it is that Scrooge is being kind of coldly utilitarian, even in the middle of all of this joy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he like, even in the middle of the fact that people are really, really happy to be in the situation that they're in, he's still like, yeah, but what about the practicalities? And I think that's one of the areas where the character strikes a bit more familiar, really, to your average. Mm. Kind of to your average person, because I think we all know, or at least work with people who are kind of the joy they take in the world seems to be in telling everybody else to calm down because it'll only get worse.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that this is Scrooge here, not so much being mean-spirited as he's being like genuinely pragmatic. Maybe that's the progress he's made from being mean-spirited to being the kind of person who's like sort of, yes, you know, fun's all very well, but really now. And he thinks he's gone through a major transformation, and the Ghost of Christmas Present is like, no, what the fuck, man? It's Christmas. Smiley, smiley, happy, happy, all right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a nice. That's a nice reading of it.
Yeah, thank you.
So we visit the Bob Cratchit household, which is the clerk that Scrooge employs.
Mm.
And it's a really close-knit family scene. There's this bit where Martha, I think, which is either one of his cousins or nieces or someone like that, always comes around for Christmas, and they play this joke on Bob Cratchit to say that she's not here, and then she sort of bursts out of the cupboard.
Oh, it's classic kind of lame family joking, isn't it? It's the kind of joking that you'd never put on TV, but when it happens amongst your family, it's really, really fun, just because it's spending time with your family and it's really enjoyable. But it is totally lame, right down to Bob Cratchit going, "Oh, you got me."
Yeah, it's very there's some really classic bits in this where you've also got Bob Cratchit's wife fussing and worrying about how good the pudding's going to be, and everybody just basically losing their shit over how great the goose is going to be when they eat it. There's a real sense of excitement, isn't there?
There is. And I tell you what I wasn't expecting to see. I was just expecting this to be like Nostalgia Fest, like plug directly into the bit of my hindbrain, which has its own Christmas memories, and populate. But again, yeah. Dickens is a better writer than that. And he actually kind of drew me into the experience that I hadn't really thought about before, which is that this is probably one of the only times in the year that the family has this amount of meat.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, if you, you know, you're living on a kind of a miserly wage in London, you know, the kind of place where you get one day off a year, you probably can't afford meat very much. So they're all talking about this goose as though it's kind of like the yearly occurrence of like the actual Easter Bunny, or, you know, just like this incredible kind of bounty. Mm. I really felt it. I really, you know, I think their joy comes from the fact that they're going to enjoy something great that they never get to experience usually.
Mm, yeah. And all this excitement culminates in Bob's son, his youngest, is called Tiny Tim, and is this little sort of little kid with he's got some kind of disability because he walks with a crutch, and he's only about 4 or 5 years old, and it ends with him saying "God bless us, everyone."
And you know what, Matt? The thing is, I tried, I did. I tried to, because I knew it was coming, and I tried to get myself in the headspace where it would be something other than an abominable cliche, but I couldn't do it. And so pretty much the whole of this was sort of, he's going to say it, isn't he? I wonder if he actually says, oh, he does, he actually says that. Oh, no. And I recognize that this makes me Scrooge. I recognize that, and I wish it didn't, but it did.
I think this is one of those moments where it's the story's a victim to its own success, insofar as the constant retellings of it have made this a complete cliche. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you read this when it was published, it'd be like, oh, that's what a great way to sum it all up. But now it's just, oh, God bless the world again, right?
Is it okay. Really being told by an endearingly wasted little kid, wasted away, not hammered, that'd be amazing, Tiny Tim. Guys, God bless us, everyone. That's what it should be. Yeah. No, but it's, you know, this is kind of little pitiable kind of being whose role in the story is to die, and he's going to say something chirpy,
spoiler alert,
vaguely uplifting. Oh, well, maybe not, though, you see, Matt, because in this story, maybe there are no spoilers, eh? Because he's showing him the future. Maybe the future doesn't happen, eh? Eh? Yeah. Schrodinger's fairy tale, that's what this is.
Yeah.
But, yeah, all of that just kind of adds up to me being like, oh, yeah, and Tiny Tim.
Yeah, so the thing is, though, with Tiny Tim, he obviously is a sick child, and Scrooge says, you know, do you know if Tiny Tim's going to live much longer? And obviously the Ghost of Christmas Present kind of says, you know, this isn't really my area, being the Ghost of Christmas Present, but
are we back on the clock in clock out approach taken by these ghosts? Just a bunch of Jobsworths, like, look, I'm the 12:30 p.m. Ghost of Christmas Present, all right? If you want to talk about the future, that's another department, and you'll have to fill in a form.
Well, actually, the Ghost of Christmas Present is such a nice guy. He does go that extra mile for the customer. He says, you know, I don't know for sure, he says, but I see a vacant seat where Tiny Tim, and sort of a crutch resting against a vacant seat, which doesn't sound good. And Scrooge is obviously upset about this, and this is the moment where the Ghost of Christmas Present throws one of Scrooge's comments back in his face and says, you know, if this child's going to die, you may as well go ahead and do it and decrease the surplus population.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And he deserved it as well, didn't he? If he's going to come out with stuff that's that sort of rampantly heartless, then he absolutely deserves to have it flung back in his face. What's the matter, yeah, Scrooge? If he dies, better for everybody else. Right. Right. Yeah.
It's quite cleverly done, that, because it really touches on something which it happens a lot in modern day politics, especially in that it's easy to make sweeping statements about, you know, should cut benefits to people, or you should send immigrants home, things like that, when it's all abstract. But when you bring it down to this person, that person, it's much harder to make the argument, isn't it? And mm-hmm. and you're confronted with the reality of the theory, if you like.
Yeah.
So we have that, and then at the end of this sort of little scene, if you like, which Scrooge is witnessing, they hold a toast to the person who made all this possible, as in the person who pays Bob Cratchit, Scrooge. And it's not exactly a universally popular toast, because they feel that he's the reason that they are in such poverty that they, you know, get super excited about just having meat one day. But Bob Cratchit says, you know, come on, it's better than nothing, and he's not a bad guy for all the, you know, poor treatment that Cratchit's received at the hands of Scrooge. He still has some kind of, I'm not sure if his affection, but sort of just respect and gratitude towards Scrooge for whatever he's paying him.
Well, it's almost a function of, like, heroic human decency, isn't it? Where he's like, sort of, yeah, all right, he's not a good man, but we should toast him anyway. You know, he's not a good man. Like, he seems to be trying to look for the good in somewhere where even the person in question is convinced it probably doesn't exist inside him at this point.
Yeah.
And Cratchit's still so good-natured that he's like, no, always look for the good.
Yeah. So after this, we pull away from the Cratchit household, and we go on this sort of quick tour of other parts of the country where they're celebrating Christmas. We go to a place where miners live, which is this barren wasteland with this little hovel in the middle of a field. And even there, you know, people are celebrating Christmas. Then we leave Yorkshire and we move on to...
Hey.
You having that one?
You can't. Could not resist, could you?
From our non-British listeners, that is me, someone living from Lancashire, having a go at someone from Yorkshire. It's a stereotype, but there's two northern areas of the country which constantly accuse the other of being dour and barren. As opposed to the great, great light, bright hope of the north, which is, of course, where you are from.
And all of this, to continue this historical theme for a moment, all of this derives from a war which took place more than 600 years ago. So we're all very proud.
Can I just say, which we won? Thank you. Which
you won. I'm not going to get into where the actual holdings of the houses of Lancaster and York are, but they're not in fucking Lancashire and Yorkshire, for damn sure. But
well,
we digress.
It is for the purposes of this story and this podcast.
Oh, you can't make any unilateral declarations that way. No.
Okay. There's the hovel in unspecified part of the country, which we go to. Then we go to. There's a light.
I'll be honest with you, Matt. There was a strong feeling of Bolton about it. Sorry, no, carry on.
How dare you? there's a lighthouse which we go to, where there are you know, these two grizzled old blokes wishing them each other a Merry Christmas. And then we sort of fly out across the sea to a ship where the sort of two watchmen at the top of the ship are again. There's these sort of elements of Christmas again, even, you know, out in the middle of the North Sea on a freezing cold ship.
Yeah.
I really liked this little tour around the place, and it felt very Victorian and quite gritty, but you don't normally get it in the adaptations either. One of the interesting things about the story in general, and the time, it really shows how it's a product of its time, is this idea of Britain pretty much is the whole world, isn't it?
And
when he does this, as you said, when he does the sweeping, let's take a look at all the different ways we celebrate Christmas, it's all about how this country does. It's sort of this mindset from the 19th century when obviously you've got the height of empire and all this, and it's just this belief that everything that matters is British.
Yeah. Yeah, very true. I mean, well, it's like that thing about stamp collecting albums back in those days. There was a big section at the front for Britain, and then at the back it was foreign stamps. Just absolutely. Like, I can't think of a better little shorthand for the way the Empire used to speak about itself.
The also-rans at the end.
Yeah, the also-rans, including, like, America, Russia, India, these places. Nah, foreign that. Put them in the back.
Yeah.
It must have been quite groundbreaking then, really, to have a kind of, you know, we're all in it together, this is the world kind of swoop and locate characters in loads of different places talking to one another. Because now it's a cliche. Now, in fact, that's one of the only ways you can really write stories about the modern world because everybody's so connected with mobile phones and Skype and so on.
Hmm.
But back then, you know, the principle that everybody... Well, within a certain cultural context, everybody everywhere was celebrating this thing, and Scrooge isn't, is a really powerful way of pointing out to him that he's missing out, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, the message isn't everybody else is doing it, why aren't you doing it? But it's just pointing out the huge variety of different circumstances in which Christmas can be celebrated and can be a sort of joyous thing. Brilliantly, actually, little anecdote for you. With the guys on the ship, my grandpa's father, grandpa's brother, used to be in the Navy, and he was actually on board ship when my grandpa and my grandma got married.
Oh.
And so he wasn't able to be at the wedding, obviously. But he set an alarm for himself in the middle of his sort of 4 hours of snatched sleep so he could wake up, pour himself a glass of whiskey, toast the health of the bride and groom very, very loudly, and then go back to sleep again.
Oh, superb. Yeah, that's great.
How fucking brilliant is that? Just this sense of being connected from the ship to the shore and being aware of this stuff that's happening.
Yeah.
And this kind of global kind of perspective. I absolutely love. Apparently, the other lads he was sharing a room with weren't so keen about the fact that he did it in such a loud voice at 3 a.m. whatever.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, the Christmas thing, it's like modern day, I don't know, soldiers who were posted in Afghanistan celebrating Christmas.
Yeah, exactly.
Thinking of home. We go back from this sort of larger, sweeping view of Christmas, back down to a household again, and this time they go to Scrooge's nephews. If you remember, this is where Scrooge was invited to for Christmas and turned down. And they're talking about it, the people gathered round saying, oh yeah, the nephew saying, you know, I invited him again and he turned me down, but I'm going to keep inviting him every year. And you never know, one year he might turn up. Although they don't really expect him to.
Really want him to either, do they?
No, they're kind of moaning about him a bit as well. There's this, I mean, there are a series of games that they play him. And some of the guests around here, there's obviously the nephew and his wife, and then his wife's plump sister. And this bloke called Topper.
And Topper's keen. We can say that. Topper's keen.
He's looking for some action, Topper.
And he gets it as well. He gets it behind the curtain in the middle of one of the games they're playing. Dickens is just kind of transcribing this all in the, oh, and a merry time was had by all. Christmas traditions are plenty. Pass the parcel. Drinking sherry. Two people cavorting behind a curtain in the family room while everybody else has a fun conversation. What?
Yeah, but, you know, Scrooge is loving all the games. And
yeah.
And he sort of, it's like that thing where, you constantly turn down an offer to do something. And when you finally actually accept, you find you really enjoy it. And he's really getting into it, and he's begging the spirit to stay a bit longer and, you know, for a couple more games. And he's kind of realizing here, isn't he, just what he's been missing. And then they play another game, which is Yes and No, which is kind of like, well, it seems the same as the modern day 20 questions, if you ever played that. So someone thinks of something and then everybody asks a lot of yes and no questions and tries to guess what it is. Obviously, you can't ask, what is it that you're thinking? That's the one caveat.
You just know, though, that every year they have to sit down and for the benefit of the smart-assed eight-year-old. Now, you can't just ask.
Yeah, for one, it's not a yes or no question, to be fair. Now, the thing that the nephew's thinking of is Scrooge, and this is quite a nice way of him poking fun at him, because a lot of the questions can be answered in a sort of a double meaning way. So, you know, is it a wild, angry animal, something like that? And he says, yes. But even when it's revealed that sort of it's Scrooge, he doesn't really mind, does he? He sort of almost laughs along with them because he's just gotten into the spirit of things so much. Which as we'll come on to next week, but that's quite different to how it's been retold quite a few times. It turns out that during this time, the Ghost of Christmas Present is aging, and he was this massive, big booming laughter giant of a man in the prime of his life when Scrooge first came across him. And now he's grey and he's getting older before Scrooge's eyes. And the Ghost of Christmas Present says, our lives are very short. So, you know, they only last a day, if you like. And then Scrooge realises that underneath the ghost's cloak, there are two children. It all gets a bit horror again now, doesn't it?
Yeah, really, there's a bit of a screeching right-hand turn into this, isn't there?
Yeah, and it's these two wasted, desperate-looking children who the Ghost Christmas Present refers to as ignorance and want. And what did you make of this handbrake turn?
It was a bit weird, and again, he wants it to be allegorical, and you can tell that because he gives them abstract names, these kids, instead of Bob and Carol, you know.
Imagine if that's what it was. Who are these two wretched children who up until now haven't revealed themselves from beneath your cloak? Oh, these two, it's just Bob and Carol.
Yeah, what of it?
They just live under my cloak.
Yeah, no, it's not weird. It's not weird. It's very warm. Perfectly acceptable.
Yeah. No, it's no. Don't ignorance call the and social. Want. Yeah, so it is obviously.
Ignorance and want. Well, perhaps this is Dickens making a bit of a swing to kind of validate Scrooge's point at a certain level, where he's like, kind of, even all this Christmas joy hides kind of very piteous, the fact that a lot of people do still experience hardship during Christmas time, and that while maybe he's trying to have his cake and eat it, in a sense, because while he's kind of presented Christmas as this time of great abundance, you've got the goose and there was so much stage and onion stuffing that there was too much to go around and so on. Mm-hmm. Maybe he wants to make the point that people are still kind of starving, particularly make the point to Scrooge that, you know, I'm showing you what Christmas can be, not necessarily everything that it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and he says on the forehead of ignorance, the boy, is scrawled doom. And it's basically the ghost going back to the whole purpose of these three visits, which is the short, sharp warning to Scrooge as to the path that he's taking at the moment and the destructive nature it's having on other people and on himself. And ignorance is the biggest danger to Scrooge, more so even than want. I thought it's useful because it gives the Spirit Ghost Christmas present a bit more of an edge, doesn't it? Rather than just this jolly guy, and also it sort of moves the tension and the atmosphere in the direction of that Dickens wants it to go to in time for the last of the spirits.
That couldn't be a more inappropriate fanfare than this last spirit. Music, are you serious? Surely what we need here is to crack out the full pipe organ and just have some slow, low building, ominous tones. Crack the trumpet out. The Ghost of Christmas Present Future comes in, okay, hooded and cowled, okay, and terrifying, and you're giving it da 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 da.
Hiya! It's me.
Me again.
Ghost of Christmas Future.
Do you not remember me? Oh, you will. You will.
Yeah, okay. Well, instead of that fanfare, it's the... If you can basically imagine the music that The Undertaker walks into in WWF, that's what we're talking about. Yeah, so the Ghost of Christmas Future just appears through the smoke here. Scrooge doesn't get to go back to bed for this one. And he's basically the modern day, what we think of when we think of as death, isn't it? It's this guy in a massive black cloak. You can't see his face. With the exception of having a scythe, he's basically death, isn't he?
Yeah, pretty much. I wonder if there was a pre-existing image of death as presented this way, or if this is one of the many things that A Christmas Carol actually originated.
Yeah, possibly. If so, I wonder where the scythe came from.
Yeah, well, the scythe makes it. Maybe it's earlier than this. Maybe I'm being a bad historian here, I don't know. But it's just, I do kind of wonder about that. Mm. Also, he's a great presentation of the hooded and cowled figure of death.
Mm.
This just totally mute and insistently pointing at really creepy shit.
Yeah,
fantastic.
I think maybe he's come out. I mean, Dickens maybe drew on. So it's like he's like a scary monk, isn't he? He's got the robe and the cowl, and that sense of cutting off from the world is he's silent. He doesn't speak. He just points at various things ominously.
Although I have to say, there were moments during this where he kind of, you know, when we reach a point where the other ghosts would give us a little bit of exposition, and instead he just points at stuff. And Scrooge kind of plays off him, and I did have this really horrible kind of image. It felt really funny. It felt like Family Guy, like taking him to some kind of scene, and Death just like points, totally mute, and then Scrooge is like, "What do you want me to look at?" Point. But I can't see anything. Point. Point. Really long pause. Point. Just like I couldn't actually help laughing a little bit, which is a bit sad.
Did you think it was going to point, and he's still not getting it? The ghost would just whip his cowl off and just go, "Oh, for fuck's sake, Scrooge! This is really simple stuff.
This is not difficult. Literally, children in the future, my area, by the way, bit of an expert, in the future, children are going to understand this before they can really walk around by themselves. You, on the other hand, need fucking flashcards. All right, here we go. You're a bad person. Flip. Get better. Flip. You're going to die. Now fuck off."
Yeah, so the first thing they see is this. It's another Christmas, sometime in the future. And there are these traders talking to each other about this guy who's died. And there are a few friends of Scrooge, sort of business friends, if you like. And they say that this bloke's died. And they don't really have any sort of view either way on sort of whether it's a bad thing. So, did you know he's died? Oh, well. Scrooge can't work out who this person may be. We may have a clue ourselves. They move into a rough area. So this sort of back end rundown part of town where there's this pawn shop owner called, and pawn as in selling things, called clarify
pawn
that
shop owner, pawn shop owner called Greasy Albert. Open all hours of the day and night.
He's called Old Joe. And these three people come in with a few things to sell on, which they've scavenged. One of them being bed curtains and a shirt, a best sort of a really nice shirt taken from this guy's corpse. And I think this is the moment where Scrooge works out pretty much who it is. He says, hang on, let me bring it up. Page 90. Yeah, he says. Scrooge says, "I see the case of this unhappy man might be my own. My life tends that way now. Merciful heaven, what it is!" I'm not 100% sure whether he realizes this is him, or whether he thinks this is the kind of person he could end up being.
Yeah,
but doesn't actually make the distinction that these people, these bed curtains are literally his.
Yeah, I quite like the fact that the next scene is the ghost not speaking, but in essence going, "How fucking stupid are you? All right, here it is. There's a gravestone. What's it got written on it, Scroogey?
Yeah.
What's it got on it? Is it Scrooge?" Message lands.
Yeah, we've got a bit more, going around the houses before that, where Scrooge says, he actually goes back to the bedroom, Scrooge's room. So Scrooge must know now that it's him, kind of, because he's in his own bedroom, and there's this corpse under a sheet, which sort of the Ghost of Christmas Future points to and says, pull down the sheet and see who it is. But Scrooge can't, because you can't affect things in this world. All you can do is just watch. So a bit of a mistake from old Christmas Future there.
Misstep.
And Scrooge says, obviously nobody's mourning this person. And Scrooge says, "Show me someone who feels emotion at this, at this man's death." And they go to this family, or this man and woman in this home in a poor part of London, and they are relieved at the fact that this guy's died because they owed him money and he was a really harsh creditor.
I quite liked the reasoning here. Is like, it starts off with like, do we have to pay him back? No, we don't. He's dead. God, and then who's the debt gonna go to? Oh, don't worry about it. Whoever it goes to could not possibly be worse, could it?
Yeah. Then we move on to Bob Cratchit. And this is this is really, really sad, isn't it? You can't see Bob. It's just his family at first. And they're talking about him and they're worried about him because he's really struggling to deal with the death of, it turns out, Tiny Tim. And they say of him, he's walked a little slower than he used to, and that it takes a little bit longer getting home from work now. And it's really a nicely painted picture of a grieving family, this, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is the place where you really feel the humanity of it. Like, where they kind of, I feel like at the start of the scene, at the start of our interaction with the Cratchit family, like it's a little bit cheesy, in fairness. But this bit was just like, man, you could just see it. Just the human emotion that's being spoken about here was just completely undeniable. And really, really quite heartbreaking. And the bit where Bob Cratchit kind of breaks down because his son's died, I was like, yeah, it's just, wow. Mm. Like, it genuinely moved me.
Yeah. And I think it moved Scrooge as well. And also, it's funny, Bob Cratchit says that he's bumped into Scrooge's nephew on the way home and he's been really nice about it, even though he doesn't know him. And again, it's just this contrast with Scrooge.
Yeah.
Then we visit the graveyard and Scrooge gets to see his own headstone. And he says to the spirit, are these the shadows of things that will be or may be only? He's now, they've done the job well, these three spirits, because he's now in a real state. He's desperate, and he's saying, "Can I change this, or is this just, you know?" If, and he says, "You know, effectively, if this is inevitable, why bother showing me? So I must be able to change it, mustn't I?" And the Ghost of Christmas Future gives him no answers, and Scrooge works himself up into this state where he's like, he's grabbing his hand and saying, "Come, you know, help me." And suddenly he realizes the hand, the sort of what he's grabbing, the robe, is actually his own curtains, and he's back in his own bed.
You couldn't have written this more perfectly for transitions in animation, could you?
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, like there are certain moments where, you know, like you zoom in on his face and suddenly everything's changed. Or he's like, he's grabbing the cloth and the cloth turns into his curtains. Or at one other point, one of the ghosts turns into his bedstead. And you're like, was Charles Dickens working for Walt Disney or something? This is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's really perfectly done, isn't it?
It really is. Like, it couldn't, you know, just take out the he said, she said, and you've got a script.
So now we've got the end of it, the final chapter, where Scrooge wakes up. He's a changed man. He's bouncing around his bedroom, delighted that he's still alive. He can't believe that he's got another chance. And he says he's as happy as a schoolboy. And he sort of runs to the window, opens it, throws it open, and there's this sort of poor little kid wandering along the street, and he shouts at him. He goes, "What day is it?" And he goes, "Why, sir, it's Christmas Day."
An hour and a half of recording, Matt, I've waited for you to crack out your impression of a London street urchin saying today's Christmas Day, Governor. And it does not disappoint.
Yeah. And then when Scrooge tells him to go and buy this massive prize turkey, the response he said, the little kid, is "Walker," which appears to be to mean sort of, "I don't believe you." That's a bit of a sort of obvious time, isn't it? Because it doesn't really translate these days.
I really love really old slang like that. Just where you have to read it and from context go, "Oh, apparently that was the way you said goodness gracious me back then." Fucking hell. You know, how that was said in the streets of London in the 1840s.
Yeah. But he does convince him to run off. Scrooge convinces this kid to run off and buy, or sort of say he wants to buy, this massive turkey to send to Bob Cratchit. This is sort of a anonymous sort of gift, if you like. And Scrooge is sort of rubbing his hands together in glee, thinking of how much joy it's going to give this this family, which is obviously very nice.
He's delightful. He's clearly had a transformative experience. But I have to say, and this was something that was ruined for me by, I'll tweet the link to this. There was a comic that I saw online pitching this particular scene. And the idea, you know, this kid running down the street and going, "Open up, open up. I want to buy the turkey in the window." And the guy's going, "It's Christmas Day. The turkey in the window is made out of fucking plaster. What's the matter with you?" I know, but whatever it is, sell it to me. Because I think if I take it back to him, he's going to give me like £1 million or something. He wouldn't give £1 million to his own mother. I know, I reckon he might put me in his will before they cart him off. Come on, get a move on. Because, I mean, the point of the story is, of course, that everybody responds to Scrooge with a great deal of grace and kind of welcomes him back into the very idea of him being reasonable. But if he was this much of a dickhead, I would actually expect the boy in question to be like, "You're Scrooge, aren't you? Nah, fuck off." Like, I don't know what game you're trying to pull here, but it's definitely not the one that ends with me getting extra money for running down the street.
Yeah. You think there'd be more suspicious of Scrooge's motives?
Yeah, I do. And which, maybe I am Scrooge de Tutti Scrooge. Maybe like I'm more Scroogey than even Scrooge himself. But that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, well, Scrooge has a couple of other things on Christmas Day. He bumps into the guy who was asking for collecting for charity way back at the start, and he sent packing on his way saying, "I wish to be left alone." And offers to make a big donation to him. And he goes round to his nephew's for the party. And he turns up there and he's welcomed in and, you know, has a cracking time with his nephew and Topper and the plump sister and all that.
Sorry, is it bad that during the scene I was sort of waiting for Topper to go and hide behind a curtain again and be like, I'm over here?
Yeah. And then we're just left with Boxing Day, back to work day, as it was then. And Scrooge plays a joke on Bob Cratchit, where he sort of sits at his desk and waits for Cratchit to arrive. Cratchit arrives late because obviously after the massive turkeys turned up, they've just had this enormous blowout at Chateau Cratchit. So he turns up about 20 minutes late, scurries in, sits at his desk and starts working. And Scrooge starts to bollock him and almost gives the impression that he's about to fire his ass. And then says he's going to give him a pay rise.
Oh, risky move, though, isn't it? Like, Scrooge is clearly 24 hours into being a decent human being. He's so confident in his identity as a decent human being that he could pull this kind of flip reverse. But, like, in fairness, you wouldn't blame Cratchit if halfway through that he just went, well, right, do you know what then? Fuck off. Fuck you and this fucking job. Do you know what I mean? Just like getting right in his face.
It's better than that because as he's doing it, it says Cratchit thinks about grabbing something and just smacking Scrooge with it and getting carted off to a mental asylum as some desperate way out. That'd have been a brilliant end.
That's the postmodern Christmas Carol, isn't it? All the way the same up until this paragraph where Cratchit just hauls off, absolutely hammers him, and then gets taken away yelling, I regret nothing!
Yeah, Scrooge is like, no, you don't understand!
It's only a joke! You know what this reminds me of? Is there's this, I don't think this is an urban myth. I think this actually happened, and if it did, then it's just a sad indictment of basically everything. But, There was an office in the States where they ran it was sort of, I don't know what it was like, mid-2001 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Mid-99, sorry. And they ran a competition in the office for something like fairly, like difficult-ish, but not too difficult.
Mm.
And said, you know, the prize for this competition, it's designed to kind of bolster staff self-esteem and so on. The prize is going to be a Toyota. And so everybody gets really, really excited. And there's this woman, it works in the office, worked there for ages, never really felt a sense of being appreciated or anything. And she wins the competition.
Yeah.
And a manager, big smile on his face, goes, oh, congratulations, fantastic. Right, go out in the parking lot and the prize is out there. And she goes out there looking for a car and she finds on the floor a little Yoda doll from Star Wars, and she's like, what's this? And he's like, yeah, it's your prize, it's a Toyota. And that actually happened is the thing.
Oh my goodness.
That's not a joke, that's just the most David Brent piece of management in the history of David Brent pieces of management.
Oh.
Do you know what I mean? But it actually happened.
Oh no, that's terrible.
I know. That's the kind, and you could forgive Cratchit for being in that sort of position here, couldn't you? Just expecting that to happen to him.
Yeah. Well, luckily, Cratchit doesn't smack Scrooge over the head and get carted off to jail or a hospital. He waits to hear him out and ends up getting offered a massive fat raise for his trouble. And then we're into the sort of the ending montage. which they always seem to do in these classical books. So we find out that, you know, over the years, Scrooge was a kind and brilliant man for the rest of his life. Tiny Tim survived and, you know, Scrooge became a second father to him. The Cratchits were much happier. Scrooge was a much better guy. He got on with his nephew. And everybody lived happily ever after. And we end with this quote again. I'm sure you enjoyed it, Dave, for one. The Tiny Tim, God blesses everyone.
I was filled with joy, Matt, as you can imagine.
Loved it.
No, it's all right. It'll do the job. Like, it's great. It's wonderful. It's just overused to the point of meaninglessness, which is really sad.
Yeah, again, it's a lovely way to round off a story before you've seen it told 100 times since, which lessens the impact of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, And that's that. That is the original Christmas Carol.
Yeah, I really liked it. And like I said, there were a few moments where, despite the fact that this is like almost the most cliched story imaginable now because it's been done so much, where I was genuinely moved by a few of the moments. And I thought, that's just phenomenal writing. If you can write something that becomes an archetype, but which when you read it still feels fresh, that's just incredible.
And I also think one of the points you made last time about this particular Dickens story, that it's very tightly written compared to some of his other stuff, which can ramble a bit. It there's no fat on it, and it's just you can fly through it in you know, an hour or so, and just feel like you've had it. You've had a fantastic experience, and it's a really great book.
That's true. Actually, it doesn't feel brief, even though it feels quick. Like you sit down and you experience it, and I mean, I suppose this is the era of the novel, that kind of the equivalent of a Christmas special, isn't it? Sit down for an hour, watch it, big smile, and that's it. Like you say, sit down for an hour, finish it, and you've gone on a journey.
Well, we'll have more of the general reaction to the book. If you want to give us a review of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, send it in to sharkliveroyalpodcast@gmail.com. That's sharkliveroyalpodcast@gmail.com. We'll be doing those next week, and we'll also be looking at some of these. We've touched on them already, some of them anyway, retellings of A Christmas Carol, because, as you know, it's one of the most retold stories, this, especially over Christmas. So we'll be doing a bit of that next time, just to let you know, to give you a taste of a few of the ones we'll be looking at. Muppet Christmas Carol, obviously. Mickey's Christmas Carol. Scrooged, which starred Bill Murray, which is a sort of a semi-modern day take, was a modern day take about 20 years ago. There were a couple of other ones that I'll keep under my hat for now, because they're one of them in particular is very special indeed. until then, so if you've got any other suggestions for us to other Christmas Carol retellings to look at next week, again, just send them to sharkliveroyalpodcast@gmail.com, or you can get us on Twitter @sharkliveroyal. But until next time, Dave.
Until next time, Matt.
Fire up that DVD player and get watching some retellings of the classic A Christmas Carol.
I am. Do you realise that you're injecting significantly more Christmas cheer into my last week of work than that would otherwise exist there?
Gotta love it. Gotta love it.